him, not even his age. His name is adopted, meaning the immigrant, leading some to believe he was born in Saudi Arabia, which is in fact true. He never allows his photograph to be taken, nor has he appeared in an ISIS video. He is scornful of the internet theories saying he was born in Texas and studied at a music conservatory in Italy. What is known about al-Muhajir is that he is a hardcore terrorist. As the mouthpiece for ISIS, he released audio statements celebrating heinous torture and murder. When President Trump visited al-Assad Air Base in Iraq last Christmas, but left quickly due to security issues, it was al-Muhajir who mocked the president's hasty departure. How strange for a victor who can't even announce publicly an official visit to a country he claims to be bringing peace and stability to. He could only come like a frightened and cowardly thief, al-Muhajir said. In his latest speech on an ISIS website, delivered after 50 Muslims were murdered by a white supremacist in a New Zealand mosque, al-Muhajir closed with a warning about the use of electronic devices. If ISIS's practice of killing is to continue, the group must avoid surveillance. But the truth is, the internet is vital to the ISIS jihad. More than 40,000 young men and women from at least 90 nations have traveled to Syria and Iraq to join the Islamic State. Many are Middle Eastern, but a large number arrive from Europe, Australia, Russia, and the United States. Almost all come from politically stable nations with low unemployment and a high level of economic development, so it is not poverty that is driving ISIS recruitment. It is simply a powerful desire to wage war in the name of religion. Footnote: researchers from Lebanon-based Quantum Communications identified the common reasons an individual chooses to join ISIS as a recruit: status, identity, thrills, redemption, revenge, ideology, justice, and death. End footnote. The average candidate is a 26-year-old male who has been inspired by violent ISIS social media posts on Facebook, Twitter, Telegram, and YouTube. Recruiting websites often show videos of the 300 beheadings that have taken place since ISIS assumed control of Iraq and Syria, as well as documentaries about life inside the Islamic State. But while this manipulation of the worldwide Muslim population requires a high level of technological savvy, ISIS leaders like Abu Hassan al-Muhajir never know when some intelligence analyst will track their cell phones. So caution is the word. The rolling claustrophobic cylinder smells of benzene and is completely dark. To avoid suspicion, hatches and valves are all closed tight, leaving just small ventilation holes to let in fresh air. The paved road is smooth, but al-Muhajir can feel every bump, for there is no padding and no place to sit. He must simply lean against the metal walls. But the potential ISIS leader is not complaining. Better discomfort than extinction. There are very few men within ISIS leadership who share al-Muhajir's Saudi Arabian heritage. So he is quite familiar with the Arab who guided U.S. Special Forces to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's compound. They know each other by name. But the spokesman does not know that his colleague has betrayed the jihad. And he is completely unaware that this betrayal has led to him being monitored on this lonely highway tonight. The road passes the ancient city of Aleppo, a 3-hour drive from where al-Baghdadi died yesterday. The phony gas truck follows a small pickup down a 2-lane desert road. Night is coming. Headlights on. Al-Muhajir can only see the blackened interior of the space that will soon become his tomb. He is being watched by Americans at an airbase thousands of miles from northern Syria. A young pilot is receiving confirmation of his target and the verbal command, "Cleared hot." The official go-ahead to launch Hellfires. A Hellfire missile does not miss. It features a millimeter wave radar system that delivers the weapon on target with such complete precision that pilots use the term fire and forget to describe the hellfire's path of destruction. So Abu Hassan al-Muhajir is already a dead man, though he does not know it. General Qasem Soleimani is also taking a very personal interest in ISIS developments. It is not just because the supreme leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei, has issued a takfir, a declaration of apostasy against the Islamic State. Soleimani sees ISIS as a tactical threat because it is a Sunni organization, thus a threat to Iran. The so-called Islamic State is neither Islamic nor a state, is the belief of the Iranian government. Those practicing Iran's Shia version of Islam are considered infidels by ISIS, which routinely murders them and levels Shia mosques. As the size of its caliphate grows, ISIS comes to control land stretching all the way to the Iranian border. When the Pakistani Taliban swear loyalty to al-Baghdadi, Iran is put in the difficult position of having yet another group of Sunni extremists nearby. Qasem Soleimani sees the big picture. The growth of the Islamic State puts it at odds with the general's ambition to control the entire Middle East. By establishing dominion over Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen, the general will be following in the footsteps of Darius the Great, ruler of Persia in the 6th century BC. Footnote: Darius the Great of Persia ruled the Achaemenid Empire from 522 to 486 BC. He developed the Royal Road, a corridor across the Middle East, to encourage communications and move personnel safely from what is now Iran all the way to the Mediterranean. Before Soleimani, the last time Iran had a powerful presence on that sea was 330 BC. End footnote. But to eliminate the Islamic State, the general needs a powerful ally. In July 2015, Soleimani decides it is time to speak with Moscow. He knows that Russia has almost no military presence in the Middle East. Syria is the ideal location for Iran and Russia to collaborate. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, an ally of both Iran and Russia, is fighting a civil war that could remove him from power. Should he be toppled, there is every possibility that a new government backed by the United States will take control. This possibility, combined with the ISIS caliphate, would render Iran and Russia powerless in the Middle East. So Soleimani directs Iranian leadership to solicit help from Vladimir Putin. The Russian leader replies, "Send Qasem Soleimani." The general has been banned from international travel by the United Nations since 2007, but that does not stop him. Soleimani flies to Moscow, where he is escorted to Putin's office in the Kremlin's North Wing. The room is rectangular, with light red curtains, matching armchairs, and inlaid oak panels on the walls. Two enormous chandeliers hang from the ceiling. The front of Putin's dark brown hardwood desk actually slides out to form a working surface. By placing a chair on either side, Putin conducts intense face-to-face discussions with world leaders. It is on this surface that Qasem Soleimani, fresh off his four-hour flight from Tehran, unfurls a map of Syria. He looks down on the 5'6" Russian leader from across the desk. Putin is a former KGB spy for the Soviet Union. A brutal and cold man, he is one of the most feared leaders in the world. But Soleimani is not afraid. After pointing out the battle sites between rebels and Syrian troops now threatening Assad, Soleimani states adamantly that the dictator must remain in power, and that Iran and Russia must work together to make it happen. Russia and Iran both depend upon the Assad regime. Russia has a vital strategic naval base in the Syrian port of Tartus. This is Putin's only warm water base on the Mediterranean, making it crucial to the Russian navy. Iran uses Syria as a land bridge to transport men and arms to Hezbollah guerrillas in Lebanon. These terrorists, like Soleimani himself, are dedicated to the destruction of Israel. Quickly, Soleimani and Putin make a deal. Russian aircraft will control the skies over Syria, preventing rebel armies from overthrowing Assad. Soleimani's Quds force, with the assistance of Hezbollah rebels, will control the action on the ground. The alliance with Russia has other benefits for Iran. It gains access to the Russian S-300 air defense system, and to Putin himself. When Moscow deepens its diplomatic friendship with Iranian enemies like Saudi Arabia and other Sunni states, it is Soleimani who visits Moscow to express concern. Now 62, Soleimani has never held greater power, but time is running out for him to fulfill his lifelong goal of destroying the Israeli state and imposing complete Shia dominance of the Middle East. Thus, the general has prepared his final solution. The Hellfire missile strikes the truck at 995 miles per hour. The explosion is intensified by the gasoline residue still inside the container. Abu Hassan al-Muhajir dies instantly. The subsequent fire and the convection effect of the small enclosure ensures that he is cooked beyond recognition. Once again, DNA must confirm the identity of a dead ISIS leader. CIA medical personnel are on the way. President Donald Trump is elated. Just confirmed that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's number one replacement has been terminated by American troops. Most likely would have taken the top spot. Now he is also dead, tweets the president. In Iran, Qasem Soleimani is also jubilant, but he remains on guard, knowing that ISIS is weakened, but not defeated. And even if that were the case, Sunni terror organizations like Al-Qaeda, which are hostile to Iran, would rush in to fill the void. So the general watches every interaction, supervises the interrogations of ISIS captives, and is poised to take immediate action against all perceived dangers. But little does General Soleimani know, there is a deadly threat hovering over him. Chapter 20. October 30th, 2019, Baghdad, Iraq, dusk. The image of Qasem Soleimani is being spit upon. Baghdad is ablaze. There have been 3 weeks of protests against Iran. Now, angry Iraqis wave their country's flag, chanting anti-Iranian slogans in the streets. The air smells of smoke and tear gas, and echoes with chants of the furious. With the collapse of ISIS in Iraq, Soleimani and his Quds force have aggressively moved in and are trying to control the country. Iran has invaded Iraq without the world noticing. Many Sunni Muslims object, and Iranian flags are being set on fire by the mob. The greatest ire is directed at portraits of General Soleimani, whom the Sunni loathe. But behind closed doors at a secret location here in the capital, Soleimani himself works with Iraqi officials to stop the protests. The general has come to offer advice, though his real motivation is to assert Iranian power over Sunni Iraq. "We know how to deal with protests in Iran," Soleimani tells the Iraqi officials. Indeed, since the demonstrations began, Quds militia fighters embedded within Iraqi military units have killed hundreds of suspected dissenters. The death toll now stands at 450. Soleimani blames America for the violence, but it is Iran stoking unrest throughout the Middle East by actively enriching uranium in anticipation of producing a nuclear weapon. Israel, fearful of such a reality, is on alert. 1 month ago, 3 Israeli spies were arrested in Soleimani's hometown of Kerman, caught while trying to dig a tunnel beneath the local mosque. The plan was to fill the hole with explosives and assassinate the general by detonating the arsenal as he attended a Shia mourning ceremony. Qasem Soleimani is confident that his Quds force is more than capable of thwarting any future assassination attempt. His deep network of spies is everywhere in the Middle East. And though he conducts his strategy in secret, the general has chosen to become a more prominent public figure by running for the Iranian presidency. The election is set to take place in June 2021. As he seeks to calm the chaos in Baghdad, Soleimani is increasing his social media profile, portraying himself as a peacemaker. Soleimani is anything but that. He is a murderer and drug lord, raking in millions of dollars to fund terror organizations that are actively killing American soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. I swear on the grave of Khomeini, I haven't authorized a bullet against the U.S., the general says. Perhaps not a bullet, but something far worse. In Washington, Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton is speaking before the Senate Armed Services Committee. The Republican is an Army veteran who served as an infantry officer in Iraq and Afghanistan. The subject is Qasem Soleimani. I know the total number of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines that were killed by Iranian activities, and the number has been recently quoted as about 500. We weren't always able to attribute the casualties we had to Iranian activity, although many times we suspected it was Iranian activity, even though we didn't necessarily have the forensics to support that. In fact, the number of Americans actually killed by Soleimani is far higher. Estimates suggest that as many as 4,500 soldiers have lost their lives or were maimed by devices supplied by the general's Quds force. Soleimani's hatred for Americans means that he does not deal in basic explosives. Instead, he favors a brutal bomb known as an EFP, Explosively Formed Penetrator, which is a leading cause of battlefield amputations suffered by American soldiers. Roughly the size of a coffee can, each device curves a thin sheet of copper into an extremely deadly projectile upon detonation, traveling at 6 times the speed of sound, 2,000 meters per second, as opposed to just 900 meters for a 50-caliber machine gun round. This shape charge is powerful enough to punch a hole in the thick armor of a tank. The devices are usually concealed inside a fake brick or rock. A passive infrared lens embedded within senses movement and triggers the explosion. The result is a supersonic teardrop of metal that severs limbs and extremities instantly. General Qasem Soleimani not only provides the EFPs to militias in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also helps them procure the training, factories, supply facilities, and even instructional videos necessary to employ the deadly weapon. And although Soleimani is correct when he says he has never personally fired a weapon at American soldiers, he has most assuredly murdered and maimed thousands of them. In Washington, D.C., Saudi Arabian Ambassador Adel al-Jubeer is a vehement critic of Soleimani. Iran is the chief sponsor of terrorism in the world. Iran has total disregard for international law and fundamental principles of international relations, such as good neighborliness and non-interference in the affairs of others. Iran has committed acts that no other country would do, al-Jubeer states in an interview with the PBS news show Frontline. Qasem Soleimani takes notice of al-Jubeer's words and decides to kill him. The plot to murder the Saudi ambassador will take place in Washington, D.C. The killer tasked with the mission is Colonel Gholam Shakouri, a Quds Force commander. The plan is codenamed Chevrolet. Shakouri and his accomplice, a 56-year-old naturalized American citizen of Iranian birth named Mansour Arbabsiar, will place bombs in a Washington restaurant frequented by the Saudi ambassador. Footnote: the name of the chic restaurant is Café Milano. The Saudi ambassador dined there at least 2 times a week. End footnote. Some United States senators and congresspeople are also likely to be at the popular bistro, but Soleimani does not care. They want that guy done. If 100 go with him, fuck him, Arbabsiar says in a call monitored by the Drug Enforcement Agency. The assassination is thwarted. Soleimani's plot is discovered by undercover agents of the FBI and DEA. Mansour Arbabsiar is arrested, convicted of attempted murder, and sentenced to 25 years in a federal penitentiary. His partner, Quds Commander Shakouri, is more fortunate. He is charged in absentia by the United States for his crimes because he has coordinated the plot from Iran, where the FBI cannot detain him. The suitcases are heavy, weighing more than 80 pounds each. The bags are lined up in a neat row at Tehran's Imam Khomeini International Airport. Uniformed Quds officials stand guard over the luggage. Mahmoud al-Zahar, a founding member of the Palestinian terror group Hamas, has come to Iran seeking financial assistance for his nefarious activities. His 9-man delegation met with Qasem Soleimani yesterday to request funding. Transferring money to a terrorist organization through normal banking channels is impossible. But there are other ways. General Soleimani has provided Hamas with 30 suitcases, each containing more than $1 million in cash. There are so many pieces of luggage that the Hamas agents cannot carry them all. The terrorists travel home with $22 million they will use to purchase weapons in order to wage war against Israel. Soleimani had agreed to more money, but there were only 9 of us, and we couldn't carry more than that, al-Zahar will lament. Footnote. The Hamas leader told this to Iran's Tasnim news agency. End footnote. Soleimani will later increase Iranian aid to Hamas by sending Russian-made Cornet missiles to Gaza, missiles that can destroy targets in the heart of Tel Aviv, Haifa, and other cities of the Zionist regime, al-Zahar will state. Among the many attacks by Hamas using the laser-guided missiles, there is one especially heinous. An Israeli yellow school bus is destroyed. When paramedics rush to help the children, Hamas launches mortar rounds on the rescuers. One student, 16-year-old Daniel Viflik, is killed when shrapnel pierces his brain. Chalk up another victim for Qasem Soleimani. The hanging will take place slowly. The accused is a drug dealer, a crime calling for the death penalty in Iran. Hundreds of people are executed each year for selling or just simply possessing heroin, opium, and methamphetamines. Iran takes a very hard line against narcotics, and these public executions are meant to discourage such depravity. And yet, these laws do not apply to Qasem Soleimani and the drug deals that fund his operations. A crowd gathers at the hanging site in Tehran. A construction crane sits in the public square, its boom raised high in the sky. A cable extends from the raised arm, dangling down to the ground. At the end is a noose. The accused is led forward, hands tied behind his back. The death loop is cinched tightly around his neck. Slowly, so as to make the hanging more excruciating, the crane operator raises the cable, pulling the condemned upward. Unlike a drop hanging, which breaks the neck immediately, this preferred Iranian method takes several minutes to completely deprive a man's lungs of oxygen. Afterward, the accused is left dangling 30 feet in the air. Sometimes, when several men are hung at the same time, a small fleet of cranes is required, and the executed swing in the wind together. Very often, the brutality is televised. The men are not taken down until families pay for the noose and the rental of the construction machinery that facilitates the killings. But not every drug dealer suffers the death penalty. Certainly not Qasem Soleimani. His elite Quds force controls the Iranian drug trade, netting millions of dollars in profits each year. Revolutionary Guard ships and planes transport narcotics to Albania, Bulgaria, and Romania. From there, they are transported into Western Europe and around the world. Soleimani runs the operation with the blessing of his good friend, the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. One Revolutionary Guard member will explain to the Times of London, We were told that the drugs will destroy the sons and daughters of the West, and that we must kill them. Their lives are worth less because they are not Muslims. The Quds drug cartel has a global reach, ensuring that Soleimani will always have access to the money he needs to fuel his terror ambitions. His actions are meant to destabilize the Middle East. Soleimani controls Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthi rebels in Yemen, and the Al-Ashtar brigades in Bahrain. He provides GPS-guided missiles, arms, and training in guerrilla warfare and terror to all those groups. Soleimani also funds cyber attacks, weapons, aircraft, and ships. Starting in May 2019, he provided drones as well. This allows the general to observe and attack U.S. forces in neighboring Iraq, as well as harass American vessels in the Persian Gulf. The United States Navy has already downed two Iranian drones that strayed too close to its ships. Footnote: in Syria alone, Soleimani funds the following militias: Harakat Hezbollah al-Nujaba, Kataib Hezbollah, Fatamiyun Brigade, 313 Brigade, Kuwat al-Ridha, Liwa al-Bakir, and assorted other local defense forces. End footnote. Iran has been a terror haven for a long time. Beginning in 1979, agents of the regime illegally seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, holding more than 60 Americans hostage during the 444 days of the crisis. Hezbollah twice bombed the American embassy in Lebanon, once in 1983 and again in 1984. Another Iranian-supported attack in 1983 killed 241 American military personnel when a truck bomb exploded their barracks. In 1996, the Iranian regime directed another bombing of American military housing in Saudi Arabia, murdering 19 Americans in cold blood. Iranian proxies provided training to operatives who were later involved in al-Qaeda's bombing of the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, killing 224 people and wounding more than 4,000 others. The regime continues to harbor high-level terrorists in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, including Osama bin Laden's son. In Iraq and Afghanistan, groups supported by Iran have killed hundreds of American military personnel. And under General Soleimani, Iran's ability to attack Americans continues to increase. The Quds Force possesses the largest and most diverse ballistic missile program in the Middle East, more powerful than even that of Israel. By 2022, Soleimani plans to have missiles capable of striking Western Europe. In 2025, a next generation of weapons will have the capacity to attack the United States. The general also has a close connection with Osama bin Laden, having sheltered Hamza, the 30-year-old son of the 9/11 mastermind. Despite President Trump's claim that the young bin Laden was killed in a counterterrorism operation in Afghanistan earlier in 2019, there is evidence he is still alive in the Iranian capital. The terror world has many tentacles, but most lead back to Qasem Soleimani. The general feels untouchable, so exalted in his country that the Ayatollah Khamenei recently bestowed upon him Iran's most prestigious medal, the Order of Zulfikar. He is the first man to receive the award since the Iranian Revolution 40 years ago. These are indeed heady times for the Quds Force and its leader. Iran is on the verge of controlling Iraq. It is aiding the killing of U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Soleimani himself is incredibly wealthy. But all the money in the world will not save him. It is another hot day in Tampa, Florida. Leadership of the U.S. Army Central Command, meeting in private, is compiling a list of reasons to take action against Qasem Soleimani. As far back as 2007, the United States has targeted Soleimani. In that year, a team led by General Stanley McChrystal observes a convoy carrying the Iranian general as it travels through northern Iraq. The general is watching from a drone satellite transmission and could fire upon the vehicles in an instant. But McChrystal hesitates to give the kill order, allowing Soleimani to slip away. Footnote: General McChrystal wanted to gain more information about the convoy before it was vaporized, but the vehicles split up in the darkness and escaped. End footnote. Shortly afterward, Israel targets a vehicle containing Soleimani and a Hezbollah leader. Once again, the United States is reluctant to pull the trigger. But 12 years later, there is a new commander-in-chief and a new set of rules for the American military hunting terrorists. Now, targets of opportunity have expiration dates, and one is fast approaching for General Qasem Soleimani. Chapter 21. December 27, 2019, Kirkuk, Iraq, 7:20 p.m. Death strikes without warning. Rockets are in the air. It is evening here at Camp K1, just after dinner. Sandbags line the perimeter for protection against terror attacks. Without warning, the first explosion hits. Men dive for cover as shrapnel flies. The sun went down 2 hours ago, making the brilliant light of the detonations visible from miles away. The rockets are deadly Iranian anti-tank weapons, most likely fired from several miles distant. The launchers are welded to cargo truck beds, allowing the terrorists to change locations immediately after firing. Camp K1 is shared by American and Iraqi troops, but the 5-foot-long Katyusha rockets focus only on the American side. More than 30 rounds land, wounding 4 U.S. service members and 2 Iraqi security personnel, and killing Nawrez Hamid, a civilian contractor working as a linguist for the Americans. Hamid is 33, a married father of 2 from Sacramento, California, and known for his gentleness. He is originally from Iraq, but has since become a naturalized U.S. citizen. The translator is a Muslim, and his body is immediately flown home for burial in accordance with the tenets of his religion. Quickly, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaks out against the attack. More than 14,000 American troops have been assigned to Iraq in response to the growing ISIS and Iranian threats. There have been 11 rocket incidents targeting coalition bases since November, but no one has been killed until tonight. This brazen attack is an act of war. The Secretary of State is blunt. We must use this opportunity to remind Iran's leaders that any attacks by them or their proxies of any identity that harm Americans, our allies, or our interests will be answered with a decisive U.S. response. 3,000 miles south of Iraq, in Mogadishu, Somalia, there is more Iranian mayhem. General Qasem Soleimani has funded al-Qaeda terror squads since the death of bin Laden 10 years ago. Now, one day after the rocket attack in Kirkuk, Iranian-backed terrorists keep a close eye on a security checkpoint in the busy hub of the chaotic city. A truck filled with explosives parks in front of a tax collection center. Truck bombings have long been a favorite Iranian killing method. It is Saturday morning, the first day of the work week in predominantly Muslim Mogadishu. Streets are filled with workers. Students walk quickly, late for class. The truck bomb explodes. Windows shatter. A percussive blast rolls outward from the place of detonation, shattering the eardrums of those nearby. In an instant, more than 90 people are dead and more than 125 wounded. Their bodies litter the sidewalks. Almost all are university students. Black plumes of smoke blot out the blue morning sky. Nearby vehicles are burning skeletons. Footnote: the attack was intended to kill Turkish soldiers and construction workers sent into Somalia to train the nation's military and build roads. Of the dead, only 2 were of Turkish descent. The Al-Shabaab extremist group, linked to Iran through Al-Qaeda, is responsible. It previously conducted a murderous rampage in a Kenyan shopping mall in 2013 and then attacked a Nairobi luxury hotel in 2019. End footnote. After seeing the carnage, Secretary Pompeo tells the world it is time for a decisive U.S. response. American fighter jets go hunting the next morning. The time is 11 a.m. United States Air Force F-15E Strike Eagles fly in formation over Iraq and Syria. Far below is the Euphrates River Valley, where mankind has waged war for thousands of years. The American pilots are vectoring toward Iranian ammunition depots and command posts that have been used by General Soleimani to launch attacks on U.S. forces. Five targets, three in Iraq and two in Syria, have been pre-selected. The sites are guarded by Hezbollah terrorists loyal to Iran. Each American aircraft has precision-guided bombs affixed to a hard point beneath the wings. Overflight in Syria means potential conflict with Russian MiG fighters, but that is a risk the American military is now willing to take. The F-15 pilots are focused on their mission, ready to deal with the Russians if needed. President Donald Trump has named his war against terror the Maximum Pressure Campaign. So far, the United States has refrained from directly attacking Iran. Trump's focus has been on eradicating ISIS, but tension between the mullahs and the United States has escalated since America pulled out of the nuke deal. The fighter pilots do not hesitate as they reach their targets, releasing their bombs and then turning back toward home base in Iraq. They see each bomb detonate, sending thick black clouds pluming into the air. Secondary explosions follow as ammunition dumps are blown up. The American attack comes without warning. There is no time for the terrorists to flee. 25 militants will die, and another 55 are injured. Footnote: these figures were announced by Iraqi security forces and the Hezbollah militia. Among the dead was Abu Ali Ghazali, an Iran-allied militia leader. End footnote. Back in Somalia, American forces of the United States Africa Command also strike. This time, another wave of U.S. jets kill the militants responsible for the Mogadishu truck bombing. The airstrikes, conducted in conjunction with the Somali government, kill four militia members at two separate sites. The lethal actions against the terrorists send a clear warning. Iran immediately pledges revenge. "Our response will be very tough on the American forces in Iraq," says Senior Commander Jamal Jafar Ibrahimi, leader of a paramilitary group loyal to Qasem Soleimani. Russia calls the American action unacceptable and counterproductive. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu immediately phones Secretary Pompeo to congratulate him. Pompeo himself issues a statement, knowing Soleimani will hear his words almost immediately. "What we did is take a decisive response that makes clear what President Trump has said for months and months and months, which is that we will not stand for the Islamic Republic of Iran to take actions that put American men and women in jeopardy." President Trump stays silent, allowing the military action to speak for itself. Baghdad is ablaze. New Year's Eve. Vandalism and arson are rampant. After 3 months, protests continue in the Iraqi capital and show no signs of abating. If anything, the tension has escalated. Thousands of Sunni Muslims are taking to the streets to condemn the Iranian military. But now they are also engaged in a war of words with Shia counter-protesters funded by Iran. A third group joins the confrontation. Mourners dressed in militia uniforms are just leaving the funeral for Hezbollah militiamen killed in the U.S. bombing 2 days ago. They march down Kindi Street, near what is known as the Green Zone. This heavily fortified sanctuary is home to the American embassy. Iraqi security forces guard a checkpoint marking the entrance to the zone, but step aside as the angry mob marches closer. Shouting "Death to America" and "Death to Israel," The mob throws rocks at the American embassy, then breaks windows and spray paints graffiti over the entry building. The outer walls of the embassy are breached. Waving pro-Iranian flags, the protesters force their way inside storage facilities and ransack files. Fire soon breaks out in the Green Zone. U.S. Ambassador Matthew Tueller is out of the country on personal travel, but the agitators do not know this. The terrorists have been instructed to take control of the embassy and parade captured staffers before the world. Soon, more militia fighters join the fracas. U.S. Marines stand atop the main embassy building, their guns trained on the pro-Iran crowd below them. Footnote: the Marines did not fire, out of fear of causing an international incident. End footnote. In Washington, a furious President Trump takes to Twitter. "Iran killed an American contractor, wounding many. We strongly responded and always will. Now Iran is orchestrating an attack on the U.S. Embassy in Iraq. They will be held fully responsible." Back in Baghdad, the militia protesters settle in for a long siege. Tents are pitched throughout the Green Zone as the angry mob forms a perimeter around the Americans trapped inside the embassy. 1,000 militia members spend the night. By morning, images of the mob are flashed around the world, allowing American intelligence to identify several of the men inciting the violence as cohorts of General Soleimani. The Iraqi government makes no attempt to dislodge the attackers, even though the terrorists are a direct threat to American embassy personnel. This is in contrast to the way Iraqis treat dissenters threatening them. Tear gas and live ammunition are routinely used. After a nighttime rest, the mob once again launches a siege. To the staff inside the embassy, the attack is clearly premeditated. "They were going around with large poles and knocking down the security cameras to limit our views on the outside of what was going on," one American security official will later note. "They were disciplined and had an agenda," another CIA agent inside the embassy will add, noting that the mob threw Molotov cocktails inside the grounds in an attempt to detonate the fuel depot. As American employees worked to battle the blazes, they were pelted by rocks. The biggest fear in the minds of embassy employees fighting back the attackers is Benghazi. In 2012, protesters attacked the American consulate in Libya, causing the deaths of several Americans. "Benghazi definitely crossed everyone's mind," one American official said. Footnote: the Benghazi attacks took place on September 11th through 12th, 2012. Terrorists overwhelmed the American diplomatic compound, killing Ambassador J. Christopher Stevens and three other diplomatic personnel. End footnote. Finally, the Marines have had enough. They fire tear gas into the crowd, and two AH-64 Apache helicopter gunships zoom low in a show of force. Word circulates among the terrorists that America is sending several hundred soldiers to protect the embassy. 24 hours after their arrival, the Shia mob marches away. "We rubbed America's nose in the dirt," one protester gloats to the press. It is now January 1st, 2020, as the embassy siege comes to an end. The death of Narez Hamid occurred just 5 days ago. Every day since has seen the threat level between Iran and the United States rise. "The game has changed," states Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, adding that American forces will shortly begin launching preemptive strikes against Iran. Nevertheless, General Soleimani feels he has an advantage. He decides to oversee a new wave of Iranian attacks on American troops. Soleimani quietly makes plans to travel from Damascus to Baghdad, hoping to provoke war between his country and America. The general boards a Syrian airliner for a flight to Baghdad International Airport. His name is not on the official passenger manifest, and the plane has been delayed several hours to accommodate his schedule. The time is shortly after 10 on the night of January 2nd. The man with 2 hours to live is walking into a trap. Chapter 22. January 3, 2019, Baghdad, Iraq, 12:32 a.m. Shamwings flight 6Q501 touches down at Baghdad International Airport. The Airbus A320, one of just 4 aircraft comprising the Syrian Airlines' entire fleet, is 3 hours late. Officially, the cause is bad weather, but the real reason is the 5 men who boarded just before departure, taking seats in the forward cabin for the 1 hour flight from the Syrian capital. General Qasem Soleimani sits in the front row, as always. He wears dark slacks and a shirt buttoned to the throat, but no tie. The rest of his entourage dresses the same. The only real difference is the prominent silver ring with a stone of red carnelian worn by the general. Footnote: red carnelian is believed by some Muslims to bestow blessings on its wearer. End footnote. Among those making the trip are loyal longtime bodyguards Hadi Taremi and Vahid Zamanian. Both are Quds Force members. The general is also accompanied by 2 top Iranian officials, Major General Hossein Pourjafari, Soleimani's right-hand man and founder of the Quds spy agency, and Colonel Shahrood Mazafari Nia, a Quds intelligence officer specializing in Syria and Lebanon. Soleimani trusts each man completely. The white aircraft with the dark lettering along the fuselage taxis to the large modern terminal in Baghdad. As the plane pulls up to the gate, passengers in the rear remain seated, not making a move to leave the craft until Qasem Soleimani and his entourage exit the front doors. The men do not walk the jetway into the terminal, nor do they wait in line at customs. Instead, Soleimani's team exits down a long stairwell to the tarmac. They are met by a longtime ally, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the gray-haired founder of the Qatayib Hezbollah militia. The terrorist guides Soleimani's party to 2 SUVs parked near the aircraft. The vehicles then drive away, exiting through a cargo gate. In all, the 2 cars hold 10 men. General Soleimani believes he is completely secure. But in fact, he and his men are being followed from 20,000 feet in the air. CIA Director Gina Haspel has been monitoring Soleimani's travels all day. She knows that he flies commercial, often buying tickets on several different airlines before selecting one just before takeoff. She has informants in the Damascus airport watching the general, hoping to make a positive identification and confirm which airline he is flying. The director knows Soleimani is not flying to Iraq this evening to conduct a peace mission. Instead, the general is meeting with his militia allies to plan more attacks against U.S. troops. Soleimani's goal is ridding the Middle East of all American forces. Ms. Haspel agrees that now is the time to deal with General Soleimani. But that decision has already been made. President Trump signed off on lethal action shortly after the embassy in Baghdad was attacked 5 days ago. Footnote: Senator Lindsey Graham was notified of the attack while visiting President Trump in Florida 1 day after the embassy siege. Eric Trump, the president's son, tweeted on December 31st stating that the United States was about to open a big old can of whoop-ass. That tweet was quickly deleted. End footnote. For years, American intelligence has compiled a list of the world's top terror targets. Soleimani has long been among the most wanted, but has avoided assassination through covert movements and stealth. But now, the general's current location and intention to harm Americans are known beyond any doubt. Informants confirm Soleimani's presence on Flight 6Q501. Deeper-level informants within the Quds Force have relayed the general's movements in Syria and Lebanon over the past 3 days. There is even word that Soleimani is being betrayed by a close friend, similar to the Arab who informed on Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The drones have been circling for almost 4 hours. Footnote: each Reaper drone costs $32 million. End footnote. The actual number of unmanned aerial vehicles now over Baghdad International Airport will remain classified, but there are at least 2 MQ-9 Reaper drones training their high-definition cameras on the vehicles carrying Soleimani and his men. Preparations for this moment began long before the general boarded the flight from Damascus. Armed with informant information, personnel at Al-Assad Air Base in northern Iraq and Al-Udeid Air Base in the Arabian Peninsula nation of Qatar began readying the Reapers for flight late this afternoon. Each MQ-9 is 36 feet long with a wingspan of 20 meters. Maximum takeoff weight is 5 tons, with much of that fuel and weapons. A propeller at the rear of the Reaper provides power. Technicians enter the hangars housing the drones and run a series of tests on the cameras, which are capable of clearly photographing the name on a golf ball from 3 miles in the sky. A small truck then tows the drones onto a runway, accompanied by 2 U.S. Air Force personnel who walk alongside and conduct last-minute visual safety checks. Thousands of miles away, remote pilots at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada fire up the engines. The drones emit the sound of a small Cessna aircraft. The pilots then push the throttles forward. Each drone labors down the runway and lifts into the air. Aloft, the Reapers soar toward Baghdad at 200 knots. The drone launched from Iraq requires just 30 minutes to get into position. The UAV from Qatar will take 5 hours. Soon, bad news. Soleimani's flight is delayed. The operational range of the fully armed drones is 14 hours. And the aircraft from Qatar may have to return to base if the holdup continues too long. But then the flight crew and the CIA team tracking Soleimani's movements catch a break. The flight to Baghdad finally departs Damascus at 10:30 p.m. The Reaper based in Qatar will have plenty of time to do its job. At Creech Air Force Base, 35 miles outside Las Vegas, two-person teams of Air Force pilots from the 432nd Air Expeditionary Wing monitor each Reaper. The drones remain in position over Baghdad. Video screens in front of each pilot show a clear image of 2 vehicles driving the perimeter road. Having been on target for several hours now, the air crews know the layout of the airport. They well understand that once the SUVs depart and head east toward the Tigris River and the heart of Baghdad, they will blend in with many other cars. But for now, the targets are the only vehicles on the road. It is not known whether the remote pilots are briefed on the identities of the men they will soon kill. But the officers are certainly aware these SUVs are a threat to America's national security. General Soleimani sits in the back seat of one Toyota vehicle next to Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. 2 Hezbollah terrorists drive. Soleimani has ordered the 4 men from his entourage to ride in the other vehicle so that he and al-Muhandis can discuss strategy privately. The airport is dark. No planes or landing so late at night, and despite the presence of runway lights, there is little activity other than that of the 2 cars on the perimeter road. Baghdad, and the secret location where Soleimani will spend the night, is 5 miles distant. The drive into the city will take them past the Green Zone and the American Embassy, the scene of Soleimani's most recent triumph. The general has had a long day. It is well past his preferred early bedtime of 9 o'clock. But a strategy discussion is a good use of his time. Sleep will come soon enough. The soft propeller thrum of the drones at 20,000 feet is imperceptible to anyone on the ground. And unlike jet aircraft, the Reaper does not leave a distinguishing white contrail in the sky. It is also the middle of the night in Iraq, which means no chance that a sunbeam reflecting off the drone will give away its position. Back in Nevada, there is talk among the pilots about the vehicles they are tracking. Not that it matters. In a few minutes, there will be no vehicles. The order comes at 2:55 p.m. Las Vegas time. It is 12:55 a.m. in Baghdad. Qasem Soleimani is excited about the future. He is not a man given to regrets, preferring to always look forward. At 62, despite his prostate issues and back pain related to his many wounds from the Iran-Iraq war, he exudes a healthy demeanor. His mind works feverishly, always thinking of ways to benefit Iran. His children are grown. He has unlimited access to drug money, and his power will only increase when he wins the Iranian presidency. Also, it is good to be sitting in the back seat with his friend Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The engineer, as the 65-year-old Hezbollah leader is nicknamed, has been waging terror war even longer than Soleimani. The Iraqi was a longtime foe of Saddam Hussein and has served the Quds Force as a special military advisor. As they discuss the next wave of violence to be inflicted upon the United States, Soleimani and al-Muhandis most likely speak in the casual shorthand of two friends in complete agreement. The driver and bodyguard sitting in the front seats know better than to speak or listen. So the only sound in the SUV is that of Qasem Soleimani and the engineer having a conversation. Until it is not. A Hellfire missile travels supersonically, so the loud sound of its rocket propellant directing the deadly weapon toward its target is a few seconds behind its actual flight path. And at almost 1,000 miles an hour, it takes a very short period of time for a Hellfire to approach a target when fired by a drone 4 miles up in the sky. In addition, the drone cameras are so precise that the pilots back at Creech Air Force Base can see which vehicle Soleimani is riding in. They actually watched him get in, knowing he will never get out. The last sound the general hears on Earth is the split-second roar of a Hellfire rocket. Two missiles slam into his car. A third missile, then a fourth, obliterate the vehicle carrying his security team. Drone photos of the destruction show two flaming mounds of metal. Everyone inside is burned beyond recognition. But one thing does remain of Qasem Soleimani. Even as his body is ripped to shreds by the direct hit from the back-to-back Hellfires, commingling his parts with those of his confederates, the hand of the general is seen clearly. His silver and red ring, remaining on his finger, now lies with the severed hand on the shoulder of the road, illuminated by the flaming hulks of the two destroyed cars. The rest of Qasem Soleimani is just missed. Footnote: the 10 men killed were medically analyzed by Iraqi security forces before being handed over to families for burial. The remains of Qasem Soleimani were identified by his ring, but those of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were never located. End footnote. Iran is stunned. Sputtering to respond, the mullahs dither. They could be next. Although the Iranian protest is predictable, it is muted. But not so with other demonstrations of disgust. All around the world, anger is being directed at the United States of America. Even though a mass killer has himself been killed, President Trump and the United States are soon portrayed as the real villains. Chapter 23. January 3, 2020, New York, New York, evening. The long knives are out. Rachel Maddow of the MSNBC cable news network wears all black as she looks into the camera. Her guest, wearing a lavender suit, is former Obama National Security Advisor Susan Rice. Ms. Rice's scheduled appearance to promote a new book coincides with the killing of General Soleimani. The two women appear on a split screen with Maddow on the left. The U.S. had previously assessed that it would be more dangerous to kill Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds force in Iran, than to allow him to live, Maddow begins. There's a lot of discussion about that reporting now that this airstrike has happened. Is there any reason to think that calculation somehow changed? Judging from what I know and from what we're likely to see, I think there's real reason to believe that in all likelihood, the benefits will be outweighed by the risks, Susan Rice responds. Footnote: MSNBC is a division of NBC News. It presents information solely from a leftist perspective. The guest, Susan Rice, misled the world about the 2012 terror attack in Benghazi, Libya. Ms. Rice is presently Joe Biden's top domestic advisor. End footnote. On another cable channel, CNN news anchor Becky Anderson joins the list of those criticizing the decision to strike Soleimani. She is British, one of the network's international personalities. Her comments about the late general's assassination go out around the world. Earlier, we heard U.S. President Trump justify the operation, saying he acted before Soleimani could carry out more attacks against Americans. Have a listen, she begins. A video clip rolls showing Donald Trump announcing the successful assassination from the White House. Last night, at my direction, the United States military executed a flawless strike that terminated the terrorist ringleader responsible for gravely wounding and murdering thousands and thousands of people and hundreds at least of Americans. He was planning a very major attack, and we got him. The segment then shifts, showing images of an Iranian mob. News anchor Anderson narrates the voiceover.